Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Good afternoon, everyone. First off, this is Mitch Rosen, head of real estate at Yield Street. And this is our third webinar in our series titled Headwinds and Opportunities in the CRE Market. I'm joined today by two friends, two partners, two folks that we really value here at the Yield Street family, Gary Zevenbergen and T.R. Hazelrig. Before I introduce them, I want to just kind of give a word of hope and health for everyone out there who's listening. We appreciate you joining us today. We appreciate you being part of the Yield Street family, and we hope you guys find this educational and time-worthy and interactive as well. So we're going to do our best here to make this fun and enjoyable for you guys. First, I have Gary Zevenbergen. He's the co-founder and CEO of Avatar. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
In addition to working on the underwriting origination side at Avatar, Gary also oversees loan servicing, banking relationships, accounting, and budgeting. Prior to Avatar, Gary was the CEO of Pacific Investment Management Company, where he chaired the loan board and grew the portfolio to well over $150 million. Prior to that role, Gary spent about 19 years as an accountant in both the public and private sector, and we're happy to have him here. Thanks, Gary. T.R. Hazelrig. Hey, T.R., how are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
T.R. is also the co-founder and president of Avatar. T.R.'s main role at Avatar is focusing on underwriting and origination. He also oversees all marketing and advertising activities for the company. And prior to Avatar, T.R. also worked with Gerry at the Pacific Investment Management Company. He was an account executive, and he became one of the nation's leading originators of non-conforming loans. He's established a nationwide network of brokers and appraisers and investors and has really worked with Gerry to grow the Avatar platform nationwide, really. So happy to have them here, happy to have them as part of our team and be a partner. And so with that, guys, let's dig in here.
You bet. So, and I'll thank Gerry for being bright enough to hire me in 96 out of USC.
That's right. That's exactly right. So let's start with a topic that a lot of folks have read about, have heard about. And I say that revolves around changing behaviors, right? The longer that COVID and or impacts of COVID drag on, folks work from home longer and longer, that has some short-term impacts and obviously some longer-term impacts. And deciphering which ones actually go back and revert to the norm and which ones stick around is really important when you invest in CRE, particularly just given it touches so many different aspects of daily life. I was curious to see what you guys think is on the shorter side, what is maybe here to stick around, whether you want to look at it by asset type. You can start by that.
Sure. I think one of the most obvious, just because if you look at a microcosm of probably everybody on this call's personal business. We at Avatar, we're not a large company, but we've just realized through this that there are parts of our company staffing that, especially being in Seattle and horrendous traffic, people are commuting 45 minutes, sometimes an hour each way, and that some of the members of our team are really much more efficient and quite a bit happier not making that commute. So I do think it's pretty obvious to most people at this point in the thing 3 months into COVID that probably in your own life, you're realizing that there are definitely parts of your business that can be completed remotely. So that I think long-term, I think everyone's in agreement that there'll be some shrinkage of footprints in major markets and maybe some fleeing to sub-markets.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You want to touch on maybe retail and hotel, Gerry?
Well, and just to tag on what TR said, you know, we think about these impacts as it relates to office space, and many of these leases have several years to run. So it's going to take a while to see what is actually going to happen when it comes time for renewal. surveys recently done have indicated people plan on reducing their footprint when renewals are there. And I think a spinoff on that is the, you think of all of the businesses in a metro area that depend upon people coming to the office. They're going to lunch, they're stopping by the drugstore, they're doing a lot of things that are going to change the economics of the impacts around urban areas. So kind of an interesting phenomenon that somewhere there's a cross between what growth is going to do and what reduction per company is going to do. So it may be a tough slog.
I would definitely echo that. I think there's a view that maybe the distancing requirements and the need for more space may actually counterbalance the desire for maybe fewer workers in the office or maybe people working remotely. It's really too soon to say how that shakes out on the office side, I think. And certainly, I think rents would have to go down to counterbalance the need for more space if it's being less occupied. So that's my view on the office side. I agree with you guys fully on that side. You want to touch on retail and hotel for a sec?
Sure. You know, one of the things that COVID has done is taken something that was a trend in retail towards more online purchases and something that was happening little by little, and it's accelerated it by, I don't know, 5 years or so. People who, you take it, our own household, we didn't buy groceries online and we didn't use Instacart and we didn't do all of these things that we're now doing. And I'm not sure why we want to go back to doing something else. So it has changed that. So retail and how grocery orders are fulfilled and drug pharmaceuticals are delivered and so on, I think this is a change that's going to be permanent. Those services that you need to, you know, personal services, maybe a cell phone purchase where you want to go in and touch it and talk to somebody, certainly getting the Eddie Manny done and the UPS store, we're going to need all of that. So there's still need for retail, but the regional malls already in a tough spot are just all the more so. Somehow those are going to have to be repurposed. It'll be interesting to see what they might do.
I was just going to touch on another product type as far as hotels, kind of what we're seeing in our portfolio, what we're hearing from people that are on the other side of the table that own these assets, manage these assets, is it's somewhat interesting that the lower end brands, your Days Inn, your Freeway Service, some of those are already seeing 50% occupancy, while your luxury brands are still at near zero. And a lot of the discretionary trips to Disney World, to Hawaii, there's something if you're doing with your kids and you're planning to do it once, no reason to do it for the next 2 years. So I think that the higher you get up in the food chain, the higher the quality of the hotel, actually the worse off they may be, at least for the next 2 years, while people are still driving, still needing to stop along the way. So these freeway service properties are doing at least what we've seen surprisingly well, considering how poor the high-end hotels are doing.
Yeah, I actually agree with that, TR. I think when you think about discretionary travel, and you mentioned, like, you know, these are larger trips, more expensive, farther travel points, and costlier. You would imagine, a lot of people thinking road trips this summer, right? Renting RVs and traveling cross country. I have like three or four friends with kids who are saying, you know what, I won't stay in hotels, I'll do an RV, I'll see some parks and make a go of it. That's going to hurt hotels. In the longer run, I am actually quite bullish on hotels. I think people like to travel. I feel like an escape. We probably have too many hotels in certain markets, but I don't think hotels have an existential threat, at least in the near term. On the longer term, I should say, from COVID.
In the long term.
Right.
2 years plus, they're back.
Right. I do think retail, and to echo what Jerry said, and we've had this conversation on prior webinars, is really at an inflection point. Jerry mentioned, you know, the UPS store, and, you know, I would echo like haircutting or a nail salon or other types of services that people cannot get online. And they want to go and take care of those things. And so groceries, you know, has a penetration rate of online shopping of under 5%. You know, to your point about longer versus shorter term impacts, there probably is going to be a migration of users who actually want to continue getting groceries delivered and avoid that friction of time and waiting online and the price check and all the jokes people make about that. There's some validity to that. I actually agree with that. Industrial multifamily, the two probably most stable asset classes that people think about right now, given what's gone on. Do you have any specific thoughts or views on those?
Well, I kind of have a thought to throw out to both of you that, and this isn't definitive at all, but it seems that in every recession I've seen before, your class B and C properties, that the people start being priced out of the price A and moving down the food group, and your B do okay and your C tend to stay pretty well occupied. This COVID is very odd in that it seems like it's disproportionately affecting lower paid workers. So your restaurant worker, people that these businesses are closed now. So that's your kind of lower class B, class C apartment. So it'll be interesting over the next couple of months to see if the B and A apartments where people can work remotely and keep a paycheck actually do a little bit better than they have in the past recessions, and the B minus C for the first time kind of take a larger hit than historical.
That's an interesting view. I could see that being the case, actually. When I think about that, that makes sense.
Yeah,
there's also this view of urban versus non-urban, right? Guard style, suburban properties, not major infill markets, but kind of a bit removed. To Jerry's earlier comment about remote working or not commuting maybe every day, but only some days, does that change where if you want to live and, you know, set up shop for their residents, right? And how that impacts multifamily, not just in New York.
Yes, suddenly having another 100 or 200 square feet in your living dwelling is quite important when that's now your home office.
Right, that's right.
Whereas people in urban areas, we've certainly seen it that the micro apartments or apodments, as they call them in the Seattle area, with very little square footage, because the theory was these young people without children are mostly at work, or they're out at a restaurant, or they're at the gym. So
right,
all that is being rebaked.
And I'm assuming you guys just, at least I'll say my view, you know, just given what we talked about in terms of the migration to online shopping, I mean, industrial has been, logistics and storage has been just an absolutely the hottest asset type the last 5-6 years plus, and probably likely going to look like that going forward. Cool. Any particular thoughts there?
Yeah, we also believe it's been the strongest asset class. It'll be I think it's going to hold up the best of any asset class, and it'll be out of the gate before everybody else. So any industrial buildings that we're seeing in major metropolitan areas, yeah, they kind of go to the top of our list of products that we, you know, asset type we'd like to have in the portfolio.
Yeah. I want to address one quick question that came on, and it's a good one. You know, we talked about the various short and longer term impacts and how that affects the various asset classes. We talked also about remote work and maybe people working from less. Someone mentioned, you know, a question about, does that really impact hotels in urban areas where a lot of the travel and the use is business related? I personally believe that while people may choose to work from home certain times, I still think it takes away the value of a face-to-face meeting, right? And kind of breaking bread with a client or potential client and trying to hash a deal out. I personally find that travel as actually beneficial, whether it be a conference or setting up meetings in a city and meeting with potential clients or brokers, whoever it may be. So I don't think that goes away. I think there'll be a reduction in that probably for some time. Like you mentioned, Jerry, 2 years. But what do you think about that?
I agree. It definitely won't go away. And there's no substitute for face-to-face and tagging. However, if there have been people getting, if you think about a manufacturer's rep who might have a route taking him through several states that typically was done on a monthly basis to touch base with customers, with these video conferences and so forth, as people are getting more comfortable with it, maybe that's still a meeting every quarter, but maybe it's not every month. And that we may have just discovered a better mousetrap. That will have some impact.
I agree. I completely agree with that. And then the impact of that on restaurants and Broadway shows in New York is an example. Like, it impacts all of that, business spending, travel, airlines, everything.
You mentioned restaurants, and I think we've had that conversation with you before. But I think, unfortunately, it's very sad, but that's the one product type where I think you're going to have a wipeout, massive bankruptcies. People that have been in the industry for 30 years, they've got portfolios of restaurants. That's the one product type where they're on thin margins. My understanding from talking to restaurant owners is anything less than 100% occupancy and they're out of business. And especially with the spike in COVID, I unfortunately think that the restaurant that you've been going to in your neighborhood for years is most likely a lot of them. A high majority will probably not be there by the time we're through this.
Yeah.
Very sad for everybody in that industry.
Yeah. It's been terrible. And the employees, obviously, and the owners who put, you know, blood, sweat, and tears into these businesses to see them grow and flourish for, in some cases, many, many years still closing. And, you know, something will come, will likely replace that at some future point. But the ones who are actually exposed now, unfortunately, are really going to be tagged pretty hard. Unfortunately, you know, it's terrible.
Well, and when you look at a mixed-use property that might be, you know, apartments above and a bit of retail and perhaps a restaurant below, with that restaurant out, it changes the value of that mixed-use property as well. And I think TR's right, and those are going to be dark for a while. They'll come back. They'll come back with a different owner. It's just part of the human experience to want to go out to, at least for Americans, to want to go out to dinner and break bread and have a drink. And I think as we're able, that's going to open up again. And there's going to be demand. Because with the weakness in retail, it doesn't appear likely to me that if a restaurant closes with all the restaurant improvements that are built in, that somebody's just going to gut that and make a hat shop out of it. It's not, they're likely just to sit vacant, I think, until restaurants are able to operate again.
I agree. With that, let's move on to our next quick topic. And that's a buzzword you hear about, you read about virtually every day is, you know, distress and defaults and non-payment on real estate and other kind of issues around just CRE in general. Because again, it touches so many different aspects of our lives, leisure, shopping, where we work, where we live. You know, you guys have both have a fantastic track record of doing this through various cycles, whether it be the dot-com crash in 2000, the Great Recession in 2008, and now obviously in 20, what we're experiencing here. Help us think about how you approach your portfolio and your lender and your borrowers, I should say. And, you know, when do you kind of take a more aggressive or heavy-handed tact versus kind of trying to work with them? And, you know, what does your experience tell you about how to best recover on loans when stuff goes sideways, which happens?
Yeah, I think going into a loan, either Jerry or I have been to each of our property. So having that personal relationship with a borrower is something that a CMBS or a major servicer doesn't have. So one of the things we learned going through these different recessions is that open line of communication with a borrower. If they're communicating, if they're being honest to you, with you, with what's actually happening, you know, we can make informed decisions as to what's in the best interest of our portfolio. And that does range, you know, in this particular last few months. I mean, we've had borrowers ask for a forbearance agreement when we know they've got, for example, $20 million of cash on their balance sheets. And that's a very quick conversation. And then we may have somebody that owns a restaurant, you know, in a great location that's closed down for now. And we understand there that, you know, that might be someone where you need to accrue interest for a couple months and give them a chance to get reopened. But it's very case specific, and it depends on not just the asset, but the guarantor's ability to make payments. So it's a kind of holistic approach of really understanding your borrower and all the different characteristics of that transaction.
We certainly do everything that we can to keep the relationship open and to be in a problem-solving mode with the borrower. There's no point in getting adversarial. You know, our legal system is great, but it's slow, it's expensive, and anything you can do to solve problems among the parties is better than that
solution. It's a win. Yeah, it's a win. I concur. And so, to lead to that, thinking about the landscape, looking forward 3 months, 6 months, a year, are you of the mindset that there's going to be a wave of really attractive opportunities as a result of what the market's experienced the last 3-4 months? Or do you think the way that many lenders have currently taken the tact of working with borrowers and forbearing or extending or modifying, whatever the case may be in each deal specific instance, you know, or do you think that banks puke loans in the next 6 months to clean their balance sheet up and kind of take advantage of other opportunities? You know, there's a lot of different views on that topic. I'm curious what you guys think.
From what I'm hearing, banks are actually being more flexible with borrowers than CMBS lenders. And it just has to do with their structure and what they can change and agree to. And I think the banks are getting pressure right now from the Fed to make things work. That will have a season and that will change. And I think by the time we get to the middle of next year, when people are filing annual reports and it's clear that they're out of compliance with their loan covenants, there comes a time when the bank's going to invite them to leave. And we think there's going to be an opportunity for bridge lenders like Avatar to take advantage of that situation. The feds are concerned about what's happening with the CMBS. I hear.
Right. So for folks on the call who aren't familiar with what CMBS is, CMBS stands for commercial mortgage-backed securities. Essentially, banks make loans, they pool them together and issue bonds against those loans. When they default, because they are sold to a pool of investors, they appoint someone called a special servicer to work through the loans. But the process is really cumbersome. It's time consuming. You don't have one direct contact point, so you're kind of working through, almost like calling your credit card company, getting a different person each time. It's really cumbersome and quite frustrating. And so it makes the workout time period lengthy and fraught with problems. And so, TR, sorry about that. I just want to give our listeners some color on that.
Sure. Yeah. One thing I was going to say is this is almost the polar opposite of when 08 and 09 hit. Then you had, I think, the regulators putting immense pressure on the banks to clean up their problems, write off their loans. And so you kind of immediately saw a bunch of opportunistic buyers coming in, both buying real estate and debt at extreme discounts. And that made for some just incredible business for us. We had very strong borrowers buying properties at significant discounts in putting in their sliver of equity and then our debt below that. I think in this scenario, we're seeing the opposite, where the FDIC and the feds are actually pressuring the banks to do the opposite. And that's give these borrowers a chance here to try to rectify the problem, because this is completely outside of everybody's control. But I'm feeling the opposite pressure from regulators that we were seeing that caused the extreme kind of meltdown in 08, 09.
I fully agree with that statement, TR. I think the desire to clean the balance sheet up post 08 was pretty aggressive. And that was a big function of, I think, the government pumping so much money into the banks to buttress them up from failing, right? FDIC didn't want to take back all these massive institutions. I think now banks are really in a much better shape from a capital buffer standpoint and the ability to absorb losses if they need to. And so they want to give these businesses the time to recover and maybe stabilize even, rather than having them kind of, because at some point, if they do fail, the government will support them in some fashion on unemployment and other ways that the employees as well as the businesses themselves. So I agree with your thought on that.
Yeah. So I just think our opportunity as a bridge lender, where it came almost immediately when the world ended, there were all these opportunities. I think the can's getting kicked down a bit. So I think our opportunity is coming. It's just not quite there yet. There's still a disconnect between a borrower's expectation of 3.5% bank money and bridge financing, and there isn't the pressure yet from the banks to kind of entice somebody to move on and get off their balance sheets.
With that, let's move on to the next topic, which is really more forward viewing and forward thinking about, okay, we know certain things, we don't know other things, right? What's going to happen and how things will shake out. But with what you know, right, what is the current strategy that you guys are thinking about deploying capital, looking at new opportunities, and what are you kind of specifically looking to do? First mortgage, what markets, and what are you really trying to stay away from? And what should we expect our users to see as we partner on more loans and close more business?
Sure. We are, at Avatar, only a first lien lender. So that's the only type of spot in the capital stack that we're looking to occupy. We are looking at most classes of assets and just feel that whatever concerns we have can usually be solved by offering a lower loan amount. That somehow solves a lot of problems. TR and I were looking at a hotel just yesterday that's a brand new property. It had been open for about 4 months when COVID hit. It's a nice brand, something we've lent on many times before. And they were asking for about 65% of cost. As we know exactly what the costs were, they just finished it. And for TR and I, that wasn't enough of a discount. we're looking, they have another asset that's free and clear. And if they'll put that up, I think we can get it around 50% of cost. And even though it's a hotel, it's a very desirable brand, and that would probably be a transaction that we have to think about very hard. Generally speaking, people are coming to us with hotel loans, and we're just kind of giving them the wave off and saying, you know, come back in 6 months, we'll revisit it. But for now, we're just, as a general statement, we're saying no to hotel properties. Any kind of a mall or a regional kind of shopping center is not working for us. And, reasons we've talked about. Smaller retail properties, office properties, we talked about industrial, of course, the ever favorite multifamily, is those are all deals that are still something we can kind of get our arms around in terms of value. Because that's the issue, is do we know what the value's going to look like post-COVID? And when's that going to happen? So just
got it.
Turns into most of the time solving that with a lower loan.
Can you talk to the demand for capital that you've seen evolve from call it March to April to May to now? Have you seen a thawing in the market? Are you seeing investors on the buying side of the equity side of real estate kind of peeking their head out and looking to get back engaged in either acquiring assets or refining assets and putting money back to work? Or is your sense that people are still really quite gun shy despite what the public markets, whether it be the stock market or other things you read about of how strong they are? You know, what's your sense on that side?
I think the opportunistic real estate buyers are standing on the sidelines because the distressed opportunities have not hit the street yet. So I think everybody's got themselves in a position where they're liquid, they're ready to launch. But again, because the banks currently are working with borrowers, those opportunities just aren't quite here yet. But I think it's a given that they'll be coming around the bend.
Right. So your view is that, I guess, you think some investors, I mean, there's always those first movers, right, who have a different view, and a 10% discount on a purchase that would have been $100 a month ago now is 90. They say, you know what? I can't time the bottom. I like the asset, I like the market. I'll make that bet. Do you just see fewer of those folks?
What we've been seeing the last three transactions we've done are what we call left at the altar. So I think that might be bulk of our business up until some of the distressed opportunities come. And when I say left at the altar, there are the CMBS markets are somewhat frozen. The conventional real estate bank lenders are also, a lot of the divisions have just plain closed for now. They just are not funding originations. And we had one borrower that was just issued loan documents and then told after that that division was shuttered for the time being. So I think there also are competition. A lot of lenders in our space are leveraged funds. They're pulling off a line of credit to actually fund the loan. A lot of those lines of credit are no longer available, or they were a one-year line and aren't going to be extended. So many of the national lenders that we compete against have stopped origination because of backroom issues having to do with their lines of credit. So I think we're seeing a reduction in competition. And for now, we're seeing some new opportunities just from both conventional and non-conforming lenders being frozen.
You kind of moved into the next kind of topic, I think, which is a good transition point, right? You mentioned, you know, a lot of leverage in the system, both on the underlying property level, but as well as the lending side, right? If I'm a lender, I make $100 loan, I may borrow 50 from a bank to make that loan and keep 50 that's subordinate in the fund or my balance sheet, whatever that may be. And your point is that those lenders, those senior lenders, have kind of run for the hills a bit. And so if you're a fund and you don't have $100 to lend anymore, you tend to kind of retrench and kind of stabilize your portfolio as it stands now and work toward getting back involved. And the question is, well, when do those guys get back involved, those senior lenders? We know just from our own conversation, it's hard to find someone that is priced appropriately for the risk they're taking and active in the market. But you guys also kind of target a different investor, right? You would take individual investors, high net worth individuals, trusts, stuff like that. Why don't you speak about that real briefly?
Sure. Yeah, that's, I mean, from 96, when Jerry and I first started, we originally had a pool that was all just made up of, it was actually really a crowdfunding company before there was such thing as that. So we had about 850 investors. And from there, we moved on to Avantar and originally started with one large institutional investor and now have kind of a broad group of high net worth family offices and institutional investors. So that makeup has allowed us to continue funding through this COVID situation. We don't have the leverage issue. And most of our investors usually are at or near retirement. So they're typically looking for an investment that's got a limited downside and being secured in a first lien. The borrowers, when there's a pullback, it's their equity that takes that hit. So we provide a really a nice risk-adjusted return for them and buy in monthly cash flow, which a lot of people are looking for that are investing with Avatar.
And Jerry, we'd spoken about your view that many conventional banks or borrowers have issues, you know, with compliance next year, second quarter, you mentioned specifically. Do you want to just talk about what that may create for us collectively as partners on some lending stuff?
Sure. I think it's not uncommon for a business to have a line of credit, funding receivables, inventory, and perhaps some real estate. Obviously, we're not receivable and inventory lenders, but when the operating results come in for 2020, if you were one of those businesses that was adversely affected by our current situation, they may be looking for another bank. They may be asked to leave. And certainly there's debt yield calculations on the real estate loans. And in general, I just think that the time will come when they're going to be kind of sorting out from their portfolio who needs to go. And they'll be feeling some pressure on that from the regulators.
And I'm already seeing that now. And I mean, an example that I just was working on last week, Class A industrial building in Irvine, beautiful property. The debt's only at 50% LTV. But the borrower there, it was owner-occupied, and they've taken a hit, and they are not meeting some of the covenants in their loan agreement with their bank that has their different lines of credit as well as is secured on the real estate. So they've been invited to exit that facility as soon as possible. So in other words, the bank's giving them a short amount of time to get that debt paid off, or you know, they'll be putting them in default. And the owner of the business did the responsible thing, and they're in a great market. They've got a new 10-year lease signed with a strong third party. They're going to be moving out, downsizing. But with the current lender, it's a relationship business with that business that's going to be moving out and that is not doing well. So where I'm looking at it as a 50% LTV and a new credit tenant coming in for 10 years, the current lender there is not a real estate lender. They just don't confuse me with the facts. The business isn't doing well. I need to be paid off. So
you're saying that they don't look to the real estate, or they don't know how to value it the right way and the way they kind of think about risk. They rather have the business being solvent and strong versus the real estate itself.
You're correct. Yeah. Any of us sitting around this table or anyone on this call, if we looked at that and said, okay, you're going to bring in a new strong tenant who's going to be signing a lease, which is, you know, a form of a guarantee, and I'm going to have plenty of cash flow through this lease to pay my real estate debt, well, we'd say no harm, no foul. You move out and we'll leave the real estate loan in place, maybe yep. charge you a fee for reviewing this, but we'd be very happy. That'd be a great solution. But for a bank, again, because the relationship was only with this failing company, they can't look at it that way or right. refuse to.
Many banks prefer to make loans on receivables, which is almost a bit of a mystery to us being real estate lenders, because we value that the security doesn't move. But receivables turn quickly. They're able to assess the validity of that asset in short order. They underwrite the company, the business, the cash flow, whereas a firm like Avatar just looks at the real estate and what's it worth in the market. So it's a different analysis. And there are banks that focus on real estate, but there are many banks that they lend to their good bank customers. They will do real estate financing. If you just walked in as a real estate investor and wanted to borrow money on an investor-owned type property, they really wouldn't be interested. They're looking for deposits. They're looking for that relationship and an ongoing borrowing.
Let's answer a couple of questions with the last 8 to 10 minutes or so that we have. One came on that's probably appropriate. We didn't talk about it, but it's self-storage or storage real estate. In my career, 20 years, I've done very little in the self-storage space. I know you guys have done some in the past. Do you have a view on that in terms of people's mobility, changing jobs more often, moving around, more of like the renter versus the owner mentality of younger folks these days? Any view on how that impacts in your, you know, self-storage and your desire to lend against it?
You've got a very diversified, unlike an apartment building that may, you may have 10 or you may have 50 tenants. I mean, here you've got, with how many units you have in mini storage, there's a lot of cash flow that can come from there. I think the main thing is underwriting what the competition is, because if you happen to have a lot of new properties coming online, then it's very problematic. So I think they can be a great asset class. It's just one where you have to really dive into the supply and demand in that niche market.
Yeah. We have found that once people rent a storage facility, they keep it for quite a while.
And it's, yeah, once you reach stabilization, it's a lot easier to stay there.
Yeah, to keep it, right. The key is getting there, right?
And speaking from personal experience, every time I've rented a storage locker and eventually went to empty it out, I have no idea why I kept all that stuff anyway.
That's so true. No, you're right. That's what people are, that's what they're begging on, frankly, is that your lack of desire to want to move this stuff again. You want to just put it somewhere, let it sit there. It becomes almost an annuity for them, right? It's kind of, It's like your monthly Spotify or Netflix subscription. It's not going anywhere. You're going to just pay that $10 every month. And unless you really want to change or make a change, it's really just kind of programmatic at that point. So that's how people like it. I personally think it's more of like a business than real estate per se. There's really no alternative use. They're often not in the most infill locations. So you're really kind of trying to pull from a broader geographic area to condense people and to give them options. But that's great. One more question.
Management's very important in those.
Yeah, concur. We have one more question that we have to hop, but I want to talk about the question came in about the repurposing of, I wouldn't say obsolete retail, but maybe like big box retail. Retail is often located in good locations, right? It's often at intersections of major highways. There's a lot of traffic and a density of people. Often they kind of look for a spending capacity of the folks that live around this mall or this retail property. There's been a lot of talk about the repurposing of these assets, right? In some cases, converting these, you know, former JCPenney's or Sears boxes to industrial use, these huge, you know, trampoline parks and other uses that, you know, entertainment, if you will. There's a lot of just views on whether that actually really is sustainable and generates positive valuation for those assets, or whether it's kind of more of a temporary fix until the next impact hits. I'm curious what you guys think about that.
Interesting that you brought this topic up right after speaking about self-storage, because
we've seen a lot of conversions.
Yeah, we've seen conversions of old Kmarts, for example, into self-storage, and that works very well. We've seen conversions to churches, which generally when you're seeing a property that was retail going to a church, it's an indication to us that the value is going down, because churches typically aren't paying the kind of rent that you would associate with a retail tenant.
It all depends on how low your basis is. If you're buying one of these lender-owned and you're picking it up at such an enormous discount, I mean, I've seen people be successful with turning a Kmart into an indoor swap meet, indoor where you walk down a just aisle every 10 feet, somebody's got their own booth and they sell trinkets or what have you. But if you can pick up those properties cheap enough, there are alternative uses. But a lot of them have a lot to do with the operator, and they're more business value than real estate.
Guys, we're up for time. I wanted to, on behalf of the Yield Street family and team, thank you both for your time today. Very insightful, very engaging. We appreciate your partnership and the continued business we've done together, and we hope for continued business going forward. On the final conclusion, please, folks, visit yieldstreet.com, learn about more upcoming offerings, and realize your next level with us.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.